shut up!"
Lloyd screamed. He fired again, and Glenn Bateman's face disappeared. He fired again, and the body jumped lifelessly. Lloyd shot him yet again. He was crying. The tears rolled down his angry, sunburned cheeks. He was remembering the rabbit he had forgotten and left to eat its own paws. He was remembering Poke and the people in the White Connie and Gorgeous George. He was remembering the Phoenix jail and the rat and how he hadn't been able to eat the ticking out of his mattress. He was remembering Trask and how Trask's leg had started to look like a Kentucky Fried Chicken dinner after a while. He pulled the trigger again, but the pistol only uttered a sterile click. "All right," Flagg said softly. "All right. Well done. Well done, Lloyd." Lloyd dropped the gun on the floor and shrank away from Flagg.
"Don't you touch me," he cried. "I didn't do it for you."
"Yes, you did," Flagg said tenderly. "You may not think so, but you did." He reached out and fingered the jet stone around Lloyd's neck. He closed his hand over it, and when he opened the hand again, the stone was gone. It had been replaced with a small silver key. "I promised you, I think," the dark man said, "in another jail. He was wrong. I keep my promises, don't I, Lloyd?"
"Yes."
"The others are leaving, or planning to leave. I know who they are. I know all the names."
"Then why don't you
put a stop to it?"
"I don't know. Maybe it's better to let them go. But you, Lloyd, you're my good and faithful servant, aren't you?"
"Yeah," Lloyd whispered. The final admission.
"Yeah, I guess I am."
"Without me, the best you could have done was small shit, even if you had survived that jail. Correct?"
"Yeah."
"The Lauder boy knew that. That's why he was coming to me. But he was too full of thoughts, too full of..." He looked suddenly perplexed and old. Then he waved his hand impatiently, and the smile bloomed on his face again.
"Perhaps it is going bad, Lloyd. Perhaps for some reason not even I can understand. But the old magician has a few tricks left in him yet, Lloyd. One or two. Now listen to me. Time is short if we want to stop this crisis in confidence and nip it in the bud, as it were. We'll want to finish things tomorrow with Underwood and Brentner. Now listen to me very carefully."
Lloyd didn't get to bed until past midnight and got no sleep until the small hours of the morning. He talked to the Rat Man. He talked to Paul Burleson, to Barry Dorgan, who agreed what the dark man wanted could and probably should be done before daylight. Construction began on the front lawn of the MGM Grand around 10 p.m. on the 29th, a work party of 10 men with welding arcs and hammers and bolts and a good supply of long steel pipes. They were assembling the pipes on two flatbed trucks in front of the fountain. The welding arcs soon drew a crowd.
"Look, Mommy," Dimmy cried. "It's a fireworks show."
"Yes, but it's time for you to go to bed." Angie Hirschfield drew the boy away with a secret fear in her heart, feeling that something bad, something perhaps as evil as the superflu itself, was in the making.
Wanna see,
Dimmy wailed, but she drew him quickly and firmly away. Julie Lowry approached the Rat Man, who was the only man in Vegas she considered too creepy to sleep with, except maybe in a pinch. His black skin glimmered in the blue-white glare of the welding arcs. He was tricked out like an Ethiopian pirate, wide silk trousers, a red sash, and a necklace of silver dollars around his scrawny neck.
"What is it, Ratty?" she asked.
"The Rat Man don't know, dear, but the Rat Man got hisself an idea. Yes, indeedy, he does. It looks like black work tomorrow, very black. Like to slip away for a quick one with Ratty, my dear?"
"Maybe," Julie said, "but only if you know what all of this is about."
"Tomorrow, all of Vegas gonna know,"
Ratty said.
You bet your sweet and delectable little sugar buns on that. Come along with the rat man, dear, and he show you the 9,000 names of God.
But Julie, much to the rat man's displeasure, had slipped away. By the time Lloyd finally went to sleep, the work was done and the crowd had drifted away. Two large cages stood on the back of the two flatbeds. There were squarish holes in the right and left sides of each. Parked close by were four cars, each with a trailer hitch. Attached to each hitch was a heavy steel towing chain. The chains snaked across the lawn of the grand, and each ended just inside of the squarish holes in the cages. At the end of each chain, there dangled a single steel handcuff. At dawn on the morning of September 30th, Larry heard the door at the far end of the cell block slide back. Footsteps came rapidly down the corridor. Larry was lying on his cot, hands laced at the back of his head. He had not slept the night before. He had been thinking, praying. It was all the same thing. Whichever it had been, the old wound in himself had finally closed, leaving him at peace. He had felt the two people that he had been all his life, the real one and the ideal one, merge into one living being. His mother would have liked this Larry, and Rita Blakemore. It was a Larry that Wayne Stuckey would never have had to tell the facts of life to. It was a Larry that even that long-ago oral hygienist might have liked. I'm going to die. If there's a God, and now I believe there must be, that's his will. We're going to die, and somehow all of this will end as a result of our dying. He suspected that Glenn Bateman had already died. There had been shooting in one of the other wings the day before, a lot of shooting. It was in the direction that Glenn had been taken rather than Ralph. Well, he had been old, his arthritis had been paining him, and whatever Flag had planned for them this morning was apt to be very unpleasant. The footfalls reached his cell.
Get up, Wonder Bread, a gleeful voice called in. The rat man has come for your pale gray ass.
Larry looked around. A grinning black pirate with a chain of silver dollars around his neck stood at the cell door, a drawn sword in one hand. Behind him stood the bespectacled CPA type. Burleson, his name was.
What is it? Larry asked.
Dear man, the pirate said, it is the end. The very end.
All right, Larry said and got up.
Burleson spoke quickly, and Larry saw that he was scared. I want you to know this was not my idea. Who was killed yesterday?
Bateman, Burleson said, dropping his eyes.
Trying to escape.
Trying to escape, Larry murmured.
He began to laugh. Ratman joined him, mocked him. They laughed together. The cell door opened. Burleson stepped forward with the cuffs. Larry offered no resistance, only put out his wrists. Burleson cuffed him.
Trying to escape, Larry said. One of these days you'll be shot trying to escape, Burleson. You too, Ratty. Just shot trying to escape.
He began to laugh again, and this time Ratman didn't join in. He looked at Larry sullenly and then began to raise his sword.
Put that down, you ass, Burleson said.
They made a line of three going out, Burleson, Larry, and the Ratman bringing up the rear. When they stepped through the door at the end of the wing, they were joined by another five men. One of them was Ralph, also cuffed.
Hey, Larry, Ralph said sorrowfully. Did you hear? Did they tell you?
Yes, I heard.
Bastards.
It's almost over for them, isn't it?
Yes, it is.
You shut up that talk, one of them growled. It's you it's almost over for. You wait and see what he's got waiting for you.
No, it's over, Ralph insisted.
Don't you know it? Can't you feel it?
Ratty pushed Ralph, making him stumble.
Shut up, he cried. Ratman don't want to hear no more of that honky bullshit voodoo. No more.
You're awful pale, Ratty, Larry said, grinning. Awful pale. You're the one who looks like gray meat now.
Ratman brandished his sword again, but there was no menace in it. He looked frightened. They all did. There was a feeling in the air, a sense that they had all entered the shadow of some great and onrushing thing. An olive drab van with Las Vegas County Jail on the side stood in the sunny courtyard. Larry and Ralph were pushed in. The doors slammed, the engine started, and they drew away. They sat down on the hard wooden benches, cuffed hands between their knees. Ralph said in a low voice, "I heard one of them saying everybody in Vegas was going to be there. You think they're going to crucify us, Larry?" "That or something like it." He looked at the big man. Ralph's sweat-stained hat was crammed down on his head. The feather was frayed and matted, but it still stuck up defiantly from the band. "You scared, Ralph?" "Scared bad," Ralph whispered. "Me, I'm a baby about pain. I never even like going to the doctors for a shot. What about you?" "Plenty. Can you come over here and sit beside me?" Ralph got up, handcuff chains clinking, and sat beside Larry. They sat quietly for a few moments, and then Ralph said softly, "We've hoed us one hell of a long row." "That's true. I just wish I knew what it was all for. All I can see is that he's going to make a show of us. So everyone will see he's the big cheese. Is that what we came all this way for?" "I don't know." The van hummed on in silence. They sat on the bench without speaking, holding hands. Larry was scared, but beyond the scary feeling, the deeper sense of peace held, undisturbed. It was going to work out. "I will fear no evil," he muttered. But he was afraid. He closed his eyes, thought of Lucy, and rested as easily as he could, trying to make himself ready. The van stopped and the doors were thrown open. Bright sunlight poured in, making him and Ralph blink dazedly. Ratman and Burleson hopped up inside. Pouring in with the sunlight was a sound, a low rustling murmur that made Ralph cock his head warily. But Larry knew what that sound was. In 1978, the Tattered Remnants had played their biggest gig, opening for Aerosmith and Led Zepp at Chavez Ravine. And the sound just before they went on had been like this sound. And so when he stepped out of the van, he knew what to expect, and his face didn't change. They were on the lawn of a huge hotel casino. The entrance was flanked by two golden pyramids. Drawn up on the grass were two flatbed trucks. On each flatbed was a cage constructed of steel piping. Surrounding them were people. They spread out across the lawn in a rough circle. They were standing in the casino parking lot, on the steps leading up to the lobby doors, in the turnaround drive where incoming guests had once parked while the doorman whistled up a bellhop. They spilled out into the street itself. Some of the younger men had hoisted their girlfriends on their shoulders for a better look at the upcoming festivities. The low murmuring was the sound of the crowd animal. Larry ran his eyes over them, and every eye he met turned away. Every face seemed pallid, distant, marked for death and seeming to know it. Yet they were here. He and Ralph were nudged toward the cages, and as they went, Larry noticed the cars with their chains and trailer hitches. But it was Ralph who understood the implication. "Larry," he said in a dry voice, "they're going to pull us to pieces." "Go on, get in," Ratman said. "Go on up there, Wonder Bread." Larry climbed onto the flatbed. "Give me a shirt, Wonder Bread." Larry took off his shirt and stood bare-chested, the morning air cool and kind on his skin. Ralph had already taken off his. A ripple of conversation went through the crowd and died. They were both terribly thin from their walk. Each rib was clearly visible. "Get in that cage, Greymeat." Larry backed into the cage. Now it was Barry Dorgan giving the orders. He went from place to place, checking arrangements, a set expression of disgust on his face. The four drivers got into the cars and started them up. Ralph stood blankly for a moment, then seized one of the welded handcuffs that dangled into his cage and threw it out through the small hole. It hit Paul Burleson on the head, and a nervous titter ran through the crowd. Dorgan said, "You don't want to do that, fella. I'll just have to send some guys up to hold you." "Let them do their thing," Larry said to Ralph. He looked down at Dorgan. "Hey, Barry.
Did they teach you this one at the Santa Monica PD?
Another laugh rippled through the crowd.
Police brutality, some daring soul cried.
Dorgan flushed but said nothing. He fed the chains further into Larry's cell, and Larry spit on them, a little surprised that he had enough saliva to do it. A small cheer went up from the back of the crowd, and Larry thought, maybe this is it. Maybe they're going to rise up. But his heart didn't believe it. Their faces were too pale, too secretive. The defiance from the back was meaningless. The kids cutting up in the study hall. There was doubt here, he could feel it, and disaffection. But Flag colored even that. These people would steal away in the dead of night for some of the great empty space that the world had become. And the walking dude would let them go, knowing he only had to keep a hard core. People like Dorgan and Burleson. The runners and midnight creepers could be gathered up later, perchance to pay the price of their imperfect faith. There would be no open rebellion here. Dorgan, Ratman, and a third man crowded their way into the cage with him. Ratman was holding the cuffs welded to the chains open for Larry's wrists. Put out your arms, Dorgan said. Isn't law and order a wonderful thing, Barry? Put them out, goddammit. Larry put them out. The cuffs were slipped on and locked. Dorgan and the others backed out, and the door was shut. Larry looked right and saw Ralph standing in his cage, head down, arms at his sides. His wrists had also been cuffed. You people know this is wrong, Larry cried, and his voice, trained by years of singing, rolled out of his chest with surprising strength. I don't expect you to stop it, but I do expect you to remember it. We're being put to death because Randall Flagg is afraid of us. He's afraid of us and the people we came from. A rising murmur ran through the crowd. Remember the way we die, and remember that next time it may be your turn to die this way, with no dignity, just an animal in a cage. That low murmur again, rising and angry, and the silence. Larry, Ralph called out. Flagg was coming down the steps of the Grand, Lloyd Henried beside him. Flagg was wearing jeans, a checked shirt, his jeans jacket with the two buttons on the breast pockets, and his run-down cowboy boots. In the sudden hush, the sound of those boot heels clocking their way down the cement path was the only sound. A sound out of time. The dark man was grinning. Larry stared down at him. Flagg came to a halt between the two cages and stood looking up. His grin was darkly charming. He was a man completely in control, and Larry suddenly knew this was his watershed moment, the apotheosis of his life. Flagg turned away from them and faced his people. He passed his eyes over them, and no eye would meet his. Lloyd, he said quietly, and Lloyd, who looked pale, haunted, and sickly, handed Flagg a paper that had been rolled up like a scroll. The dark man unrolled it, held it up, and began to speak. His voice was deep, sonorous, and pleasing, spreading in the stillness like a single silver ripple on a black pond. Know you that this is a true bill to which I, Randall Flagg, have put my name on this 30th day of September, the year 1980, now known as the Year One, Year of the Plague.
Flagg's not your name, Ralph roared.
There was a shocked murmur from the crowd.
Why don't you tell him your real name?
Flagg took no notice.
Know you that these men, Lawson Underwood and Ralph Brentner, are spies here in Las Vegas with no good intent, but rather with seditious motives, who have entered this state with stealth and under cover of darkness?
That's pretty good, Larry said, since we were coming down Route 70 in broad daylight.
He raised his voice to a shout.
They took us at noon on the interstate. How's that for stealth and under cover of darkness?
Flagg bore through this patiently, as if he felt that Larry and Ralph had every right to answer the charges. Not that it was going to make any ultimate difference. Now he continued.
Know you that the cohorts of these men were responsible for the sabotage bombing of the helicopters at Indian Springs, and therefore responsible for the deaths of Carl Huff, Bill Jameson, and Cliff Benson.
They are guilty of murder.
Larry's eyes touched those of a man standing on the front rim of the crowd. Although Larry did not know it, this was Stan Bailey, operations chief at Indian Springs. He saw a haze of bewilderment and surprise cover the man's face, and saw him mouth something ridiculous that looked like Can Man.
Know you that the cohorts of these men have sent other spies among us, and they have been killed. It is the sentence, then, that these men shall be put to death in an appropriate manner, to wit, that they shall be pulled apart. It is the duty and the responsibility of each of you to witness this punishment, so you may remember it and tell others what you have seen here today.
Flagg's grin flashed out, meant to be solicitous in this instance, but still no more warm and human than a shark's grin.
Those of you with children are excused.
He turned toward the cars, which were now idling, sending out small puffs of exhaust into the morning. As he did so, there was a commotion near the front of the crowd. Suddenly, a man pushed through into the clearing. He was a big man, his face nearly as pallid as his cook's whites. The dark man had handed the scroll back to Lloyd, and Lloyd's hands jerked convulsively when Whitney Horgan pushed into the clear. There was a clear ripping sound as the scroll tore in half.
"Hey, you people!" Whitney cried.
A confused murmur ran through the crowd. Whitney was shaking all over as if with a palsy. His head kept jerking toward the dark man and then away again. Flagg regarded Whitney with a ferocious smile. Dorgan started toward the cook, and Flagg motioned him back.
"This ain't right," Whitney yelled. "You know it ain't."
Dead silence from the crowd. Whitney's throat worked convulsively. His Adam's apple bobbed up and down like a monkey on a stick.
"We was Americans once," Whitney cried at last. "This ain't how Americans act. I wasn't so much, I'll tell you that, nothing but a cook. But I know this ain't how Americans act, listening to some murdering freak in cowboy boots."
A horrified, rustling gasp came from these new Las Vegans.
"That's what he is," Whitney insisted.
The sweat was running down his face like tears from the brushy edges of his flat-top haircut.
"You want to watch these two guys ripped in two right in front of you, huh? You think that's the way to start a new life? You think a thing like that can ever be right? I tell you, you'll have nightmares about it for the rest of your lives."
The crowd murmured its assent. Larry and Ralph exchanged a glance.
"We got to stop this," Whitney said. "You know it? We got to have time to think about what... what?"
"Whitney." That voice, smooth as silk, little more than a whisper, but enough to silence the cook's faltering voice completely. He turned toward Flagg, lips moving soundlessly, his eye as fixed as a mackerel's. Now the sweat was pouring down his face in torrents.
"Whitney, you should have kept still."
His voice was soft, but still it carried easily to every ear.
"I would have let you go. Why would I want you?"
Whitney's lips moved, but still no sound came out.
"Come here, Whitney."
"No,"
Whitney whispered, and no one heard his demurral except Lloyd and Ralph and Larry and possibly Barry Dorgan. Whitney's feet moved as if they had not heard his mouth. His sprung and mushy black loafers whispered through the grass, and he moved toward the dark man like a ghost. The crowd had become a slack jaw and a staring eye.
"I knew about your plans," the dark man said. "I knew what you meant to do before you did. And I would have let you crawl away until I was ready to take you back. Maybe in a year, maybe in 10. But that's all behind you now, Whitney. Believe it."
Whitney found his voice one last time, his words rushing out in a strangled scream.
"You ain't a man at all. You're some kind of a devil."
Flagg stretched out the index finger of his left hand so that it almost touched Whitney Horgan's chin.
"Yes, that's right,"
he said so softly that no one but Lloyd and Larry Underwood heard.
"I am."
A blue ball of fire, no bigger than the ping-pong ball Leo was endlessly bouncing, leaped from the tip of Flag's finger with a faint ozone crackle. An autumn wind of sighs went through those watching. Whitney screamed, but didn't move. The ball of fire lit on his chin. There was a sudden cloying smell of burning flesh. The ball moved across his mouth, fusing his lips shut, locking the scream behind Whitney's bulging eyes. It crossed one cheek, digging a charred and instantly cauterized trench. It closed his eyes. It paused above his forehead, and Larry heard Ralph speaking, saying the same thing over and over, and Larry joined his voice to Ralph's, making it a litany. I will fear no evil. I will fear no evil. I will fear no evil. The ball of fire rolled up from Whitney's forehead, and now there was a hot smell of burning hair. It rolled toward the back of his head, leaving a grotesque bald strip behind it. Whitney swayed on his feet for a moment, and then fell over, mercifully face down. The crowd released a long, sibilant sound. Ah. It was the sound people had made on the 4th of July when the fireworks display had been particularly good. The ball of blue fire hung in the air, bigger now, too bright to look at without slitting the eyes. The dark man pointed at it, and it moved slowly toward the crowd. Those in the front, a whey-faced Jenny Engstrom was among them, shrank back. In a thundering voice, Flag challenged them. Is there anyone else here who disagrees with my sentence? If so, let him speak now. Deep silence greeted this. Flag seemed satisfied. Then let... Heads began to turn away from him suddenly. A surprised murmur ran through the crowd, then rose to a babble. Flag seemed completely caught by surprise. Now people in the crowd began to cry out, and while it was impossible to make out the words clearly, the tone was one of wonder and surprise. The ball of fire dipped and spun uncertainly. The humming sound of an electric motor came to Larry's ears, and again he caught that puzzling name tossed from mouth to mouth, never clear, never all of one piece. Man. Can man. Trash. Trashy. Someone was coming through the crowd, as if in answer to the dark man's challenge. Flag felt terror seep into his heart. It was a terror of the unknown and the unexpected. He had foreseen everything, even Whitney's foolish spur-of-the-moment speech. He had foreseen everything but this. The crowd, his crowd, was parting, peeling back. There was a scream, high, clear, and freezing. Someone broke and ran, then someone else, and then the crowd, already on an emotional hair trigger, broke and stampeded. Hold still! Flag cried at the top of his voice, but it was useless. The crowd had become a strong wind, and not even the dark man could still the wind. Terrible, impotent rage rose in him, joining the fear and making some new and volatile mix. It had gone wrong again. In the last minute, it had somehow gone wrong, like the old lawyer in Oregon, the woman slitting her throat on the window glass, and Nadine falling. They ran, scattering to all the points of the compass, pounding across the lawn of the MGM Grand, across the street, toward the strip. They had seen the late-arriving guest, arrived at last like some grim vision out of a horror tale. They had seen, perhaps, the raddled face of some final, awful retribution. And they had seen what the returning wanderer had brought with him. As the crowd melted, Randall Flagg also saw, as did Larry and Ralph, and a frozen Lloyd Henry, who was still holding the torn scroll in his hands. It was Donald Merwin Elbert, now known as the Trash Can Man, now and forever, world without end, hallelujah, amen. He was behind the wheel of a long, dirty electric cart. The cart's heavy-duty bank of batteries was nearly drained dry. The cart was humming and buzzing and lurching. The Trash Can Man bobbed back and forth on the open seat like a mad marionette. He was in the last stages of radiation sickness. His hair was gone. His arms, poking out of the tatters of his shirt, were covered with open running sores. His face was a cratered red soup from which one desert-faded blue eye peered with a terrible, pitiful intelligence. His teeth were gone. His nails were gone. His eyelids were frayed flaps. He looked like a man who had driven his electric cart out of the dark and burning subterranean mouth of hell itself. Flag watched him come, frozen. His smile was gone. His high, rich color was gone. His face was suddenly a window made of pale, clear glass. Trashcan Man's voice bubbled ecstatically up from his thin chest.
I brought it. I brought you the fire. Please. I'm sorry.
It was Lloyd who moved. He took one step forward, then another.
Trashy. Trash, baby.
His voice was a croak. That single eye moved, painfully seeking Lloyd out.
Lloyd? Is that you?
It's me, Trash. Lloyd was shaking violently all over, the way Whitney had been shaking. Hey, what you got there, is it?
It's the A-bomb,
Trash said happily. He began to rock back and forth on the seat of the electric cart like a convert at a revival meeting.
The A-bomb, it's a big one. The A-bomb, the big fire. My life for you.
Take it away, Trash, Lloyd whispered. It's dangerous. It's hot. Take it away. Make him get rid of it, Lloyd, the dark man, who was now the pale man, whined. Make him take it back where he got it. Make him... Trashcan's one operative eye grew puzzled.
Where is he?
He asked. And then his voice rose to an agonized howl.
Where is he? He's gone. Where is he? What did you do to him?
Lloyd made one last supreme effort.
Trash, you gotta get rid of that thing, you...
And suddenly Ralph shrieked.
Larry!
Larry! The hand of God!
Ralph's face was transported in a terrible joy. His eyes shone. He was pointing into the sky. Larry looked up. He saw the ball of electricity Flag had flicked from the end of his finger. It had grown to a tremendous size. It hung in the sky, jittering toward Trashcan Man, giving off sparks like hair. Larry realized dimly that the air was now so full of electricity that every hair on his own body was standing on end. And the thing in the sky did look like a hand.
No!
The dark man wailed. Larry looked at him, but Flag was no longer there. He had a bare impression of something monstrous standing in front of where Flag had been. Something slumped and hunched and almost without shape. Something with enormous yellow eyes slit by dark cat's pupils. Then it was gone. Larry saw Flag's clothes, the jacket, the jeans, the boots, standing upright with nothing in them. For a split second, they held the shape of the body that had been inside them. And then they collapsed. The crackling blue fire in the air rushed at the yellow electric cart the Trashcan Man had somehow driven back from the Nellis Range. He had thrown up blood and finally vomited out his own teeth as the radiation sickness sank deeper and deeper into him. Yet he had never faltered in his resolve to bring it back to the dark man. You could say that he had never flagged in his determination. The blue ball of fire flung itself into the back of the cart, seeking what was there, drawn to it.
Oh, shit, we're all fucked,
Lloyd Henry cried. He put his hands over his head and fell to his knees.
Oh, God, thank God, Larry thought. I will fear no evil. I will fear...
Silent white light filled the world. And the righteous and unrighteous alike were consumed in that holy fire. Chapter 64. Stu woke up from a night of broken rest at dawn and lay shivering, even with Kojak curled up next to him. The morning sky was coldly blue, but in spite of the shivers, he was hot. He was running a fever.
Sick, he muttered, and Kojak looked up at him. He began to feed the fire with the last of the wood on hand, and then sent Kojak out for a dozen more sticks. Soon the fire was blazing. Even sitting close would not drive the shivers away, although sweat was rolling down his face. It was the final irony. He had the flu, or something very like it. He had come down with it 2 days after Glenn, Larry, and Ralph left him. For another 2 days, the flu had seemed to consider him. Was he worth taking? Apparently he was. Little by little, he was getting worse. And this morning, he felt very bad indeed. Among the odds and ends in his pockets, Stu found a stub of pencil, his notebook, all the Free Zone organizational stuff that had once seemed the vital stuff of life itself now seemed mildly foolish, and his key ring. He had puzzled over the key ring for a long time, coming back to it over the last few days again and again, constantly surprised by the strong ache of sadness and nostalgia. This one was to his apartment. This one was his locker key. This one was a spare for his car, a 72 Dodge with a lot of rust. So far as he knew, it was still parked behind the apartment building at 31 Thompson Street in Arnett. Also attached to the key ring was a cardboard address card encased in lucite. He took the keys off the ring, bounced them thoughtfully on the palm of his hand for a moment, and then threw them away. He slipped the cardboard address card out of the lucite and then ripped a blank page from his notebook. Dear Franny, he wrote at the top. He told her all that had happened up until he had broken his leg. He told her that he hoped to see her again, but that he doubted it was in the cards. The best he could hope for was that Kojak would find the zone again. He wiped tears absently from his face with the heel of his hand and wrote that he loved her. I expect you to mourn me and then get on, he wrote. You and the baby have to get on. That's the most important thing now. He signed, folded it small, and slipped the note into the address slot in the lucite square. Then he attached the key ring to Kojak's collar. Good dog, he said when that was done. You want to go look around, find a rabbit or something? Kojak bounded up the slope where Stu had broken his own leg and was gone. Stu picked up the 7-Up can Kojak had brought him on one trip yesterday in lieu of a stick. He had filled it with muddy water from the ditch. When the water stood, the mud silted down to the bottom. It made a gritty drink, but as his mother would have said, it was a whole lot grittier when there was none. He drank slowly, slaking his thirst bit by bit. It hurt to swallow. He lay back, splinted leg in front of him, and dozed. He woke with a start about an hour later, clutching at the sandy earth in sleepy panic. A nightmare? It seemed it must be, because the ground was moving slowly under his hands. Earthquake? We got an earthquake here? For a moment, he clung to the idea that it must be delirium, that his fever had come back while he dozed. But looking toward the gully, he saw the dirt was sliding down in small, muddy sheets. Bouncing, bounding pebbles flashed mica and quartz glints at his startled eyes. And then a faint, dull thudding noise came. It seemed to push its way into his ears. A moment later, he was heaving for breath, as if most of the air had suddenly been pushed out of the gully the flash flood had cut. There was a whining sound above him. Kojak stood silhouetted against the western edge of the cut, hunkered down. He was staring west toward Nevada. Kojak! Stu cried in panic. That thudding noise had terrified him. It was as if God had suddenly stamped his foot down on the desert floor somewhere not too distant. Kojak bounded down the slope and joined him, whining. As Stu passed a hand down the dog's back, he felt Kojak trembling. He had to see. He had to. A sudden feeling of surety came to him. I'm going up, boy, Stu muttered. He crawled to the eastern edge of the gully. It was a little steeper, but it offered more handholds. He had thought for the last 3 days that he might be able to get up there, but he hadn't seen the point. He was sheltered from the worst of the wind at the bottom of the cut, and he had water. But now he had to get up there. He had to see. He dragged his splinted leg behind him like a club.
He got up on his hands and craned his neck to see the top. "Can't do it, boy," he muttered to Kojak, and started trying anyway. A fresh pile of rubble had piled up at the bottom as a result of the earthquake, or whatever it was. Stu pulled himself over it and then began to inch his way up the slope, using his hands and his left knee. He made 12 yards and then lost 6 of them before he could grab a quartz outcropping and stop his slide. "Nope, never make it," he panted, and rested. 10 minutes later, he started again and made another 10 yards. He rested, went again, came to a place with no holds and had to inch to the left until he found one. Kojak walked beside him, no doubt wondering what this fool was up to, leaving his water and his nice warm fire. Warm. The fever must be coming up again, but at least the shivering had subsided. Fresh sweat was running down his face and arms. His hair, dusty and oily, hung in his eyes. "Lord, I'm burning up." He happened to glance at Kojak. It took almost a minute for what he was seeing to sink in. Kojak was panting. It wasn't the fever, because Kojak was hot too. Overhead, a squadron of birds suddenly flocked, wheeling and squawking. He began to crawl again, fear lending him additional strength. An hour passed, 2. He fought for every foot, every inch. By 1 o'clock that afternoon, he was only 6 feet below the edge. He could see jags of paving jutting out above him. Only 6 feet, but the grade here was very steep and smooth. He tried once just to wriggle up, but loose gravel, the underbedding of the interstate, had begun to rattle out from beneath him, and now he was afraid that if he tried to move at all, he would go all the way to the bottom again, probably breaking his other damn leg in the process. "Stuck," he muttered. "Good fucking show. Now what?" Now what became obvious very quickly. Even without moving around, the earth was beginning to shift downward beneath him. He slipped an inch and clawed for purchase with his hands. His broken leg was thudding heavily, and he had not thought to pocket Glenn's pills. He slipped another 2 inches, then 5. His left foot was now dangling over space. Only his hands were holding him, and as he watched, they began to slip, digging 10 little furrows in the damp ground. "Kojak!" he cried miserably, expecting nothing. But suddenly Kojak was there. Stu flung his arms around his neck blindly, not expecting to be saved, but only grabbing what there was to be grabbed, like a drowning man. Kojak made no effort to throw him off. He dug in. For a moment they were frozen, a living sculpture. Then Kojak began to move, digging for inches, claws clicking against small stones and bits of gravel. Pebbles rattled into Stu's face, and he shut his eyes. Kojak dragged him, panting like an air compressor, in Stu's right ear. He slitted his eyes open and saw that they were nearly at the top. Kojak's head was down. His back legs were working furiously. He gained 4 more inches, and it was enough. With a desperate cry, Stu let go of Kojak's neck and grabbed an outcrop of paving.